Today's presenting sponsor is Simply Safe Home Security. We talk a lot about transparency and fighting against shady deals. That's us.
That's right.
That's what we like about Simply Safe. No hidden fees, no long-term contracts, just highly effective, award-winning home security at a fair price. John Lovett installed the Simply Safe years ago, and
we've been
talking about it ever since.
Can't stop talking about it. It's a really great product. It works really well. Easy to set up. Once you set it up, the app is reliable and easy to use. The customer support is reliable. It's just a great security system you can count on. Highly recommend it.
Most security systems only take action after someone breaks in. That's too late. Simply Safe's new Active Guard outdoor protection helps stop break-ins before they happen. If someone's lurking, agents talk to them in real time, turn on spotlights, and can call the police, proactively deterring crime before it starts. Named Best Home Security System of 2025 by CNET, 4 million plus Americans trust Simply Safe. Ranked number one in customer service by Newsweek and USA Today. Monitoring plans start around $1 a day, 60-day money-back guarantee, no contracts, no hidden fees. Visit simplysafe.com/cricket to claim 50% off a new system with a professional monitoring plan and get your first month free. That's simplysafe.com/crooked. There's no safe like Simply Safe.
Hey everybody, welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Lovett. Today on the show, I sat down with Marc Maron to talk about the end of his podcast, to talk about his comedy special, to talk about politics, Trump, Theo Von, Jerry Seinfeld, Bill Maher. I think Janine Garofalo came up very briefly. We covered a lot of ground about the right, the left, life and death. It was a great conversation. Producer Austin said it was a funny conversation and one of the darkest conversations we've had. And, you know, you'll decide how right that is. But it was really great. And here it is. Hi. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Nice to be here. I've admired your work from afar, my friend.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. What about up close?
Well, I'm going to see how that goes.
Okay. When you were on Love It or Leave It in 2017, I went back and listened to it, and my takeaway had nothing to do with you. You were there, but I was mostly listening to how I sounded.
Sure.
And it was one of the first shows we did.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first times I've been doing a show on a stage, and I'm still getting the hang of it. And I remember when you came on, I really felt you not annoyed at me, but like, you're like,
yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
I felt like you needed to be won over. Like, yeah. You've been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
You think we're gonna talk. I felt you like alpha dogging me a little bit.
Oh.
But not in a bad way. It was fine. But in watching you do interviews, here's what I took from it, which is when you're with somebody you genuinely like, you will not laugh as much, but you'll sometimes throw a pity laugh at someone who's trying their best who you don't care for. And I wasn't getting that.
With people in terms of pity laughs, you know, there's an old radio habit. I don't know if people who started in podcasting, but it seems to have, there is a radio laugh that you do out of politeness, and it's instinctual. And I think after a certain point, you may not know the difference between that and a real laugh, but it is an acknowledgement. It's not always pity. It's just saying like, yeah, okay, yeah, you did it.
Got to fill the space till we get to the next part.
Well, I mean, if it's funny, it's funny, you know, but I think people know when I'm really laughing. And I think that in terms of alpha dogging, I get a little dickish.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not full power play. It's just sort of a defiance. You know, I'm defying you to bring me down a notch.
But you're setting a bar for if you're going to want to have a conversation.
Sure.
You're going to have to bring something.
Yeah, I don't know
what's going to... You can't just show up empty-handed.
Sure. I mean, yeah, because I can talk probably too much if I'm allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind it. This is the first time I've done sort of a run of guesting in a long time over the last month or so.
Yeah, no. I noticed that. I feel like you've done every podcast, and I assume left after this is maybe like the Geico caveman. Is that what's after
is
this?
Is he doing one?
Yeah, yeah. I think you're going to hit that.
I did a couple.
Petco dog.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think I'll do that. I was kind of strategic in what I wanted to do for reasons that I had.
Uh-huh.
Some of them were not the reasons that were sort of interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
I learned recently that people are going to assume they know why you did things or frame why you did things in their particular context. And I know why I did things. And it's very odd to come up against these type of people where they're like, you did that because of this. I'm like, I wasn't even thinking that.
What's an example of that?
Well, I mean, for instance, that there is this notion that, you know, I did a lot of the comedy podcasts, the more bro-ish ones that, you know, I would do or get on, you know, specifically to take them to task. And it really was the farthest thing from my mind. I just wanted to make sure that people who were fans of comedy knew that I had a special out there, you know, no matter what ilk they are. That was really the intention. Because I got into stuff that I've been talking about a long time, about the political situation within comedy, that would just happened. It wasn't like that was my agenda. I didn't want to talk that shit to Howie Mandel. I barely wanted to be on Howie's show.
That does come across.
Sure, but I mean, but it was like, you know, I know how to have fun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but he was, you know, spouting his mouth off in sort of a boomery, shallow, kind of insulated way that I thought was, you know, way off the mark. And so I didn't engage, you know, fun Mark, because it became not fun very quickly, and it became serious, and he didn't have much to say.
Yeah. Let's talk about politics, because you have been going
already?
It's just what I put on the top of the card. We can edit however.
No.
We don't have to follow this.
I'm kidding. Just do what you...
No, you're kidding.
Do what you got to do.
He's kidding. So in your special, which is great.
Yeah, thank you.
Which is great. You say it's your best.
I think so.
I like your last two. I think they're both your best.
End Times Fun, Bleak to Dark.
Yeah, yeah.
And this one. It's kind of a trilogy.
Yeah.
Panicked.
One of the things you say in the special is that liberals annoyed average Americans into fascism, and that we have a buzzkill problem. Now, a lot of the buzzkills listening to this are going to take issue with that. But what is the buzzkill problem? Like, what is it?
I think most of my specials, I speak to politics and culture, you know, in a specific way, because I think I should. Mm-hmm. I think it's my responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I especially in this last episode, I figured out a way to what I felt was finessing it, because the situation culturally and politically for this special was different than the other ones. And some sort of strange empathy kind of evolved in terms of my presentation. So I'll explain to you. I'll answer the question. But when in my last special, like Bleak to Dark, where I talked about Christian fascism, you know, it was sort of like I had some swagger to it. I was laying something down. I wasn't really exploring it. It was sort of a heads up in a fairly cocky way, in what you would say probably what it looks like as alpha dogging.
Mm-hmm.
In the special before that, I did a fairly operatic closing bit with Mike Pence blowing Jesus, which is a specific sort of homage to a comic that, you know, had an impact on me. In this special,
you gave him a blowjob.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
No, it was more like as I get older, I realize what my influences are, and I realize what part they play in certain bits. Like, I can kind of identify it. So I see it that way. I see that, like, I would not have been inspired to navigate this joke without, you know, Hicks. So that's that. But in this special, because I started doing it after the election, or maybe a little leading up to it, I found that at the audiences, in the theater audiences, that there was a frightened, desperate, angry vibe, which was, you know, justified and real and despairing. And so over time of building the material, I realized that I was sort of doing some sort of community service in a real sense, that, you know, these are, you know, liberals, Democrats, you know, Democrat liberals, Democratic liberals, whatever, to the left of center, that these people were showing up. I don't know their lives. I don't know how long they're sitting at home alone on the phone. I don't know what they're doing. But I did know they were scared, and I knew I was in the same boat. So I figured out a way. I made a decision this special to speak directly to them. You know, not just posture as one of us,
mm-hmm.
but to say, look, I'll do this for you. We're all in the same boat. We all have flaws. There's funny things about us. I don't have any answers for you, but I can give you that kind of relief of taking pokes at who we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And that joke, and I think it's a problem now too with comics and comedy, when I do comedy, when I say we annoyed the average American into fascism, that's a joke.
Yeah, it's a joke.
But it resonates, and it resonates for a reason, because I've also lately been exploring the difference between anger and hate. That, you know, anger as a tone in all its spectrum is not always entertaining. And, you know, self-righteous anger is about the most intolerable anger. Yeah, and even if you believe what the person is saying, you want them to shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
So that joke, and to answer your question, I think we know what these things are. And I don't know that there's a way around it. I mean, that's going to take some sort of amazing vulnerability and empathy in the face of a completely unsympathetic and terrifying force to make it not annoying. But I mean, I think that's sort of what's at stake.
Yeah, it's funny because...
Did that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. Well, even when I was thinking about what I wanted to talk to you about, I know when I say, you know, oh, you and the special joke about America having a buzzkill problem, annoying people into fascism, that people are going to say, well, that's not fair. It's obviously more complicated with it than that. But that's why it's a joke.
Is it? But see, and I say it in the special that, you know, in terms of a real organized left, you know, when was the last time we had that? And look, I did Air America. I know what it's like to deal with different factions of the left. And even within, you know, the Democrats trying to figure out how to platform the left, right? And I know that there's very insulated, very committed groups of people to very specific things that are all part of this big umbrella idea. But there is no unifying policy. There is no unifying community. There is no, you know, it's not as simple in terms of what it's become as what Bernie preaches, you know, the original American left, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you have all that fragmentation, what becomes annoying is people's commitment to their specific cause. As righteous as it may be, it doesn't fit into the umbrella of the community necessarily. It does not have that much significance on its own. I mean, some issues do. So it almost becomes, you know, I don't want to use the word virtue signaling, but there is a sort of righteousness. And I get the whole idea is like pick an issue and you work it. But bigger problems abound.
Yeah. My take on it is we do have a problem of being buzzkills, that the Americans do have a very dim view of Democrats. Americans do find Democrats annoying. Why is that? One reason, they're kind of annoying. That's true. Another is, yes, there's like a kind of a collective sense of loss and righteous anger and uncertainty around the fact that that's even more extreme this time, because at least in 2017, you could say, oh, half the country didn't vote for this. It's a fluke. He won the electoral vote, right, not the popular vote. But we lived through it, and then the country embraced it. And he won a majority this time, which makes it even more kind of enraging and insecure poking kind of experience for the left. But there's also a big right-wing apparatus that exists to take all these things and the most annoying liberal and make them famous.
They turn it around.
And then there's social media that takes the most bits of things. Like,
sure.
Like, you know, you make a joke in your special about Theo Von. It's very funny. It's a great joke. It is everywhere. It is everywhere. That gets pulled out, right? And it gets spread because it's great material. It's very funny. It's resonant. But it's not surprising that the more thoughtful and circumspect parts of the special, it's not surprising that those parts aren't what's online. What's online is the bit.
Well, there's
travels.
A bit about
that's sensational.
The R word and the Theo Von thing. A couple of the smaller ones did okay out there. But yeah, there's a lot in the special. And, you know, I had to think about, you know, what that Theo Von joke would do, because there's this idea, there's a talking point within the right wing, you know, tribalized comedy community that any sort of criticism is some sort of jealousy, which it isn't. And I had this issue years ago before this type of stuff. If you're going to be critical through humor of people in your own profession, there's always this sort of stigma to it. But I believe that if somebody becomes a cultural phenomenon and they are part of the cultural apparatus, that they're fair game.
Yeah.
And I think the Theo joke at its base is funny. you know, what it implies. You can do whatever you want with that. Sure, it's an easy correlation to make to Trump or to humanizing fascism. But in and of itself, the impression was good enough. You know, the jokes that I put within him talking were funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to think that he didn't think it was funny.
It's really funny. It's good. But I'm just, my point is only that, like...
Sure, the apparatus is, it's impossible to fight against. And, you know, that's a whole other problem, that the left messaging is never going to be as efficient because we don't have an army of frustrated teenage boys who have been taught over the last 20 years that this is all some sort of game and that trolling is a pastime. And they were sort of turned out and radicalized by... you know, Bannon and it just, the apparatus, it feeds itself, and people who are doing it are not ideological thinkers or deep guys. They just are in it for the game.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean about it being going further than just the left being annoying.
Of course.
But it's also the, you know, you look in the past.
I'm talking on a human level.
On a human level. But when countries have embraced right-wing fascistic leaders, right? Germany, the economy's in shambles. Millions of men were in World War I. Their brains are all fucked up. Word for it. The only advice is for everyone to whisper, right? Like, there's nothing. And they embrace this autocrat. America had a lot of problems in 2016. We had a lot of problems in 2024, more than we had before. But we don't have let's try autocracy problems. But there's something about this era, whether it's social media or what's happened in the economy, that's led people to feel this like loss of meaning, loss of purpose, loss of order, and they're casting out. And Donald Trump had purchased with a lot of those people. A lot of the people, turns out, were excited about someone like Donald Trump their whole lives. We just didn't know it, which is very frightening. But there was a lot of people that were just receptive to someone like Donald Trump in a way that I think was very surprising. It was surprising to me. I don't know if it was surprising to you.
I think that, look, anger and the excitement of being validated and having your grievances honored, despite any sort of, you know, human connection to them, I think it's appealing to angry people. And the people that weren't angry were annoyed. And they may be untethered. They may not have any real sense of civic responsibility or even the structure of government. They just knew that it felt good to be able to double down on hate and to double down on othering and to double down on bullying. I think most people have an innate bully. I think that empathy is a muscle that you have to work. Yeah. And at some point, the Democrats were okay at that. But I don't think most people are naturally empathetic. I used to think that. But I also think that a lot of this propaganda you're talking about and the sort of intensity of what we're taking in on a day-to-day level creates the mental relationship with the information, creates a kind of mania. I just watched a brilliant documentary this morning. I've watched all this guy's stuff. It's a guy, he calls himself Elephant Graveyard on YouTube. And he did, and it's, it specifically focuses on the alignment of politics and comedy. He did one called Comedy Jonestown, How Comedy Was Destroyed by an Anti-Reality Doomsday Cult. And I think that is a bigger conversation about what you're saying, that, you know, the propaganda and the existence of social media platforms and what they can do to the human brain and what they can do to foment a sort of mania.
Yeah, mania is a good word for it.
That enables it. You hear it in people on these mics. And I used to do it. I used to do morning radio. And I knew what it took to get it up to do that, you know, for 3 hours. You know, you're up at 3 a.m, you're crunching news, we're doing comedy bits, you're live. So there was a mania to it. And if that mania has a specific ideological thrust that's driven by talking points and, you know, basic debate exercises, it's rewarding and it lands and it makes you feel good. Mania makes you feel good.
Yeah, and it has sort of left, you know, conservative radio, talk radio, it was in your car. And a lot of people listened to it. You know, a lot of salesmen and truck drivers listened to it all day, every day. It was like kind of this secret audience for it. But you got out of your car and it stayed in the car and you lived your life. And now that kind of frenetic pace follows us all the time. And I do think, like, you're going to look back on this era and you say, what happened? And we're going to look at the way in which we all kind of, whatever direction it was, we were all radicalizing each other through our phones.
But radicalizing in emotion.
Yeah.
That the information is fleeting and unfounded. But if it fits your emotional feeling, then just drive it. Yeah. And now it's everywhere. People... It's in, the guy in this new documentary, in the Doomsday Cult documentary, identifies something about collaborators that may not have seen themselves as being willing collaborators at the beginning, but they go through something called, I think he called it philosocide, which is where you don't kill yourself, but you kill yourself inside. And if you look at somebody like Mark Rubio or anybody within that administration, in what happens in cult-like behavior is sometime, some point after another, in order to stay in the game, they kill whatever principles they might have had, even though they were a few.
Yeah, they surrender to it. And there's also, I think, another part
of
this.
Killing it is probably better because that sort of supports the mania element that you have to surrender, but you have to aggressively push it back.
Yeah.
Because you literally have to. Your personality is in conflict with that until it's not.
Look, we're doing Germany, we're doing 1984, deal with it. But like, you know, in 1984, it's about letting go. You know, you're fighting against this tide, you're fighting against this tide, and all of a sudden, just like, you know what? I'm just going to float.
But that's the rest of us. That's not the operatives. I mean, the operatives, you know, they make a deal.
They make a deal.
You're like, right. I mean, I, you know, have had to, on some level, believe and accept, not in the way that I surrender to it, that we're currently in an authoritarian country. I have to see it that way in order to exist in my life. I have to frame it like that. I'm not saying that there's not hope, but I do think that what we're up against is something more than a two-party problem.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Tommy John. Keeping your cool can be difficult with everything you're hearing on the news.
That's right.
Thankfully, Tommy John can provide cooling relief with underwear that feels like on-body AC thanks to lightweight, breathable, moisture-wicking fabrics that stop you from getting heated. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You can deal with the news by getting better underwear.
That's for sure. It doesn't hurt.
Tommy John's proprietary fabrics are silky, soft, and luxurious. I know it's a good day when I have my Tommy Johns on. Feel confident all day long in underwear that are breathable, lightweight, and comfortable. Get the support you've been looking for with underwear that won't ride up. Tommy Johns are up to 4 times more stretch than competing brands, but they won't stretch out. Best of all, you can buy them risk-free with their money-back guarantee. Elevate your essentials with Tommy John today. What's one special thing about Tommy John? That we all wear the same underwear.
Yeah, we do. They're very comfortable. They're really well-made. Very breathable. I truly wear them every single day without exception. Highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. You know, treat yourself right around that area, you know? It's every day. It's every day.
Try to make sure that your big balls get a Medal of Freedom.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, yeah. You know what? Your balls getting jacked. You know what I mean?
Grab 25% off your first order now at TommyJohn.com/crooked. Save 25% for a limited time at TommyJohn.com/crooked. TommyJohn.com/crooked. See site for details.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at crookedcon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
One way I think people rationalize it is around, well, you know, I don't like Trump, but I really hate the fucking Democrats, right? Or like, I'm not totally on board with this, but both sides.
Yeah, but that's a false equivalency,
of
right?
Of course it is. Of course it is. But what I see, there's a, there is a reason that Donald Trump gains purchase in this ecosystem of podcasts at the same time that a bunch of this anti-woke, anti-trans masculinity core takes hold at the same time. And it has to do with there's some way in which a lot of men feel lost. And,
sure.
And there's order and meaning in what Trump offers,
sure.
in what kind of the Rogan kind of way of learning about the world.
Bad daddies are pretty powerful.
Yeah.
And, you know, these docs that he talks a lot about, the daddy hole in these guys, you know, from bad daddies, that void that needs to be filled. And, you know, a lot of megalomaniacal people come from that. Trump comes from that.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I'm no psychiatrist or psychologist, you know, but in order for someone to define themselves, especially if they're lost or they feel neutered or diminished, if you get the right words into those people, they're going to light up. And if they feel like they have a leader, they're going to light up. And as opposed to, like, you know, well, I didn't like what the Democrats had to say or whatever, I think that is all part and parcel to the demonization of Democrats as not having real policy or not being real men or not speaking to the working class. Because there's a couple of guys out there, and I don't follow as much as I used to, but it seems like there's a couple of guys out there that are rational, level-headed, very wonky Democratic politicians that are totally inoffensive and really bright and are making it as simple as possible to understand what the real issues are. But I don't know if that's what it takes to get people on board. And then you got Newsom's approach, which is,
everyone is struggling. Look, I do think that the collapse of society can be tied back to crowd work. I think we can get it back to comedians that are just doing crowd work. In the same way, we can talk about how what goes viral, what spreads, what gets people's attention is conflict, it's anger. And so satisfying things.
Because cats do too, you know.
Right, sure. Yeah, things that scratch some sort of a primitive itch in there.
Yeah, whether it's like sweet or sad.
Yeah, cats too. Yeah, you know, a rescued puppy getting a growth removed will also get millions of...
I can watch a pipe evacuate itself for a minute.
You ever see a video of someone pulling a tire through a pipe?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
great. It's the best.
Oh, so I'll watch that all day.
I guess that's a kind of primal fecal thing.
Yeah.
Well, bring it back to crowd work is that they're, with all this othering and with all this sort of idea, this is one of their big debate points when you come at them. They accuse liberals of being closed-minded in terms of really embracing other people's point of view. And for me, if that other point of view is shut the fuck up,
I don't want to hear it. Yeah, right.
Well, I just think what happens is once the othering is successful, and I covered in the special that, you know, real rights are denied and real lives are at stake because of, you know, what comics thought was an anti-woke was just about their language issue. And now they were used in under the sort of auspices of anti-woke. You destroy all the policy that helps people who are vulnerable or marginalized or in trouble. And I can't separate them. I will remain committed to the fact that they did that, that comics helped that. But I think in the bigger picture with, say, crowd work or the kind of, you know, hackneyed tropes of tribalized comedy is what ultimately happens, and I said this to Howie, and with all the proliferations of podcasts, is that because the production values are shitty, and everybody knows them now. And because crowd work is kind of establishes this way of lighting, kind of having an improvisational moment. What happens to all the stuff that is really good and truly creative and interesting is that the bar gets lowered to the point where regular people just adapt to the garbage. And they don't seek out the other stuff. And the sort of... outlets that make the other stuff are kind of marginalized. Mainstream show business is kind of marginalized. So all this stuff fits into that anti-elitism kind of frame of right-wing thinking.
Yeah, and it does, it's about taste too, which is that this stuff performs well. It does well in the world. For good and for ill, all the gatekeepers are gone, right? You can kind of build an audience online. That's good. A lot of amazing people have started online. But we've lost there was curation.
Yeah.
Human connection was a limited resource, whether it was through art or through having to go somewhere to meet a friend. Like, you didn't know what happened to people in your life, so you saw them at a party. The party had real meaning because you connected there.
That's it.
And all of this took out the availability of all this, removed the meaning of liking a comic, discovering someone, going to a club and seeing someone's hilarious, telling your friends about
people
it.
People with researched and respected opinions.
Right.
So, yeah, I look, and I did a joke that was, turned inside out by one particular kind of libertarian, thinker. I don't even want to give him that. He's a comic. But I said it was better when everybody didn't have a voice. It's a joke.
Yeah, it's a joke.
But it's the same thing as saying, like, everyone's got a podcast now. Mm-hmm. But I just said it like that, so I left myself open to, like, that guy, see, the liberals are, they're totalitarian,
Well, it's everybody, the cancel culture, anti-woke comedy, it was about feeling like there's feedback that they didn't want to hear anymore. But I also, like, being a celebrity got worse too, which is why I think it was able to spread so far, right? Like, because, if you were famous in the 1950s, you could do coke, get drunk, drive your car through a plate glass window, give $200 to the maitre d' at the hotel, and it was gone. Now, like, James Corden gets into a fight pulling a suitcase down from the overhead, and it's news and it follows him forever. There's a way in which attention, celebrity, and feedback have made having the power of a platform less fun. And I think that annoys very powerful people.
It's predatory.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, they have to insulate themselves. But I do still think that outside of just the kind of emaciated world of press and this chasing of clickbait, I do think in terms of the ideological bend on it is that it's anti-elitism, it's anti-intellectualism, it's anti-expert. I think it's all part of that.
Yeah.
I think that Hollywood has been framed as elitists. I think that, not unlike with the universities, and the intellectual thing was always part of fascism. But I think that Hollywood represents elitism to the right. And I don't believe that's true. I mean, movie stars are movie stars, but I really think that's where a lot of that comes from, outside of just clickbaity stuff.
Yeah, and then there's also just a big audience for it, right? Like, there is, it turns out, an audience for...
Yeah, but that doesn't make it right.
Like, no, of course not.
I think that...
What does that tell us about the people listening, that they wanted this?
Well, but most people, like, so what do you got? 75 million vote for Kamala, 77.5, mm-hmm. Vote for Trump. And there's 150 people who did what? What are they doing? Who are those people? Are they just floating? Are they the ones that's watching? It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
What are they doing? So I think that in terms of how fascism or authoritarianism, like, we've got a president who is a thug. So, his way of doing business is like, oh, you got a pretty nice university here. Hate for anything bad to happen to it. It's a nice state. Oh, hate for anything bad to happen to it. Maybe you kick into the charity. Yeah. It's straight up mob shit. But Russ.
Vos Vote.
Yeah, what's vote? I mean, that's the guy that's doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
However you see Trump, he's still a puppet to something that is bigger, that he doesn't give a shit about, as long as he can be the guy out front. But those guys are the guys that are dismantling the federal government in the name of Christian nationalism. But I think that the way that business, see, what you're saying to me feels like that, fascism is good for business.
Yeah.
Because if you, Netflix will just, co-opt anybody that can tick that algorithm. And I think I used to do a joke about it. Netflix can become Reichflix, very quickly. And I think the pivotal moment was when they had pushback from the trans community about Chappelle. They realized after several days that community was not going to affect their bottom line at all.
Yeah.
And they cut them loose. And, that is how fascism works in business.
Right. Well, right. Their argument and response would be, well, we believe in being a home for everybody. So there's Chappelle, there's Ricky Gervais, there's all these kinds of comics that do the same fucking joke. And we have a bunch of gay movies and films sure. and queer stuff. Sure. And like, we're a home for everybody. And that's our answer.
Sure. But ultimately, who's getting the big deals? Which shows stay on the air?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what do they keep repeating? It's like the bigger audience. Yeah, that's them saying, like, we got this other stuff, and we know there's a few of you, but we're throwing you a bone, so shut up. But the big money's on the ones that you're talking about that titillate in a certain way that is not always right-minded. And look, I'm people can say whatever they want.
Yeah.
Like, my belief is that eventually this stuff would have found its level. That ultimately, in terms of left-leaning or specific marginalized cultures, you know, creating grassroots action, you know, by overwhelming Twitter and stuff, that it, when Trump was campaigning for the second time, that was ebbing, that it would have found a level where tolerance would have maybe reigned. Because, like, I believe that in order for democracy to work, if these guys are doubling down on intolerance and hate, that you got nothing to work with. I mean, it used to be like, you know, you'd get a guy who'd be like, yeah, gay marriage, now the gays, they want to get married, it's ridiculous, fuck the gays. And then it passes in his state, and over time he's like, I don't know, I work with a guy, you know, they're nice. And then it evolves in the way that democracy is supposed to work. But I think it should always be said that what these guys are fighting for is not democracy. And they're shameless about it. They can say that, you know, democracy enabled us to vote for that guy, but that was the fucking end of it. And that's the loophole in democracy, is that you can freely elect a fascist. And then who the hell knows what's going to happen, right? But I do feel that they are shamelessly anti-American in their political ideology. And I imagine most of them would own it.
The hope, right, too, is like, this is hacky shit, right? A lot of this, like, anti-woke comedy is, like, hacky shit. And the way you beat that, you can scold people. I'm not saying you're doing it, but people on social media can try to scold their way to the other side of it. But the answer is to just be fucking funny. And the answer is to have a bit about Theo Von that people really like and sort of clicks, turns something on in their brain.
It's subjective.
That makes it silly to them.
Sure. Right. But it's not going to make it silly to the guys that are brain fucked in that direction. It's not going to make it silly to the believers. And the problem with, like, comedy comedians as news influencers is that now anything any comic says is a representation of their personal ideology. So the ability for them to be objective about humor is gone. And they are subjective, which most humor is, to a specific ideological bent. And sure, you can make it as funny as you want. There's plenty of beautifully funny people doing amazing comedy all the time, but they're in the shadow of this momentum of the tribalized comedy of Rogan. And again, those documentaries, which I highly recommend, from Elephant Graveyard, you know, Rogan has positioned himself as the arbiter of what comedy is. And the way I framed it in my conversation with Howie was like, you know, how long can you kind of claim the victim mantle?
Right.
It's like, my question is, it's like, you guys won. Woke is dead. What do you got to keep beating these people up for? Some of them are losing their rights. Some of them are being, you know, literally killed. Some of them are being deported. And these are all the big funnies for you guys who claim to be victims of this horrible policy. So then why not stop now?
Well, but also part of it is, yeah, but then also there's this sort of, well, we're just comedians. We're just telling jokes here. And then it's like, well, hold on a second. You can't.
They're not.
You can't have the president on in the run-up to an election and give that person a forum, Trump, and not push back. You can't get behind him. And then when you don't like the consequences, say like, well, I don't like any of this immigration stuff, but I'm just a comedian. I just had him on. He was a guest.
Yeah, but still, I can't forgive it.
Don't think you should.
And it's like, in the sense that, like, well, you should have done your fucking homework, you know, before you come out and say, this is the guy, to your army of minions who look to you for intellectual fortitude and the proper diet and, you know, what is real and what isn't real. So in a sense, it's like they're going to backpedal, and they're going to backpedal in relation to what's kind of like moving through MAGA in general. And I don't know that it matters. I mean, this...
I think it does matter.
No, I mean, I don't know that it matters. Oh, if MAGA buckles and they have to accommodate them?
I think we have to be practical. And I can't go back in time and make people not endorse Trump, but people with big platforms realizing that they were... Look, we're is a decadent and depraved era in American politics and American society. And part of that is a glibness with very serious things. You have Zelensky in the Oval... He's getting questions about putting on a suit. His country is being murdered by Vladimir Putin. He's getting jokey questions. Donald Trump is showing him his fucking hat collection. This is a depraved and decadent era. And as part of that decadence, there are people being glib about life and death decisions, including endorsing a monster because it's good for the gram. And that happened. How do we help? Now, that there's a good side to that, which is there's a shallowness to that support and that embrace, which means, yes, we can say that was stupid. I don't forgive you. Fine. But we got to get those people to realize we got to make ourselves feel open to them, because those people with those platforms are maybe gettable, as are the kind of soft Trump voters that maybe got on board because all their favorite hosts liked him.
I'll agree with you with that.
OK.
But I think you're taking out of the picture. They're afraid. They're in, man,
yeah.
And they're in over their head. And, you know, there's real consequences when you push back against your authoritarian overlords. And who the hell knows what they are? Because once you get above Russ Vought, I mean, you've got the tech oligarchs, all right? So they're the real ones, you know, whoever's, you know, pawned out, you know, Vance is a stooge for those guys, for Elon and Thiel and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get above Project 2025 and you get above Trump, then you've got these guys who really seek to destroy the fabric of democratic society. Okay, so if you're on the payroll of that shit, and you want to soften up, there's a lot at stake. So it's not just sort of, well, we got to say the right thing to these people and change their minds, because. You don't think Rubio is shitting his pants every fucking day? I mean, you don't think like any judge that rules against him is getting like hundreds and hundreds of death threats? I mean, this is straight up, terrorizing shit. So I know we were heading towards hope somehow, but...
And we don't need to. Let's turn around.
No, but I think that in terms of voters and whatnot, if they are still capable of empathy, underneath this mania of grievance validation, then in so much to say as if they're still human, that maybe something will speak to them.
Well, I think that's where there is genuine hope. Trump has many powers, talents. One of them is he is very good at making what's the worst thing about you the truest thing about you. He's very good at that. He's very good at kind of reaching into somebody and saying, this thing, this weakness you have, I'm going to make that more true, whether it's animus towards immigrants or embracing their ambition over their politics if it's a politician. But one reason I think Trump was able to get back is because there was a big hole. And everybody listening will be annoyed am I saying it, but whatever, the bully pulpit, Joe Biden, he left it open. And we didn't understand how big of a price we were paying for not having a vocal, aggressive, relentless advocate for democracy, for just empathy, which is something Joe Biden, I think, is very good at, but had lost his ability to communicate well. And if we can start getting leaders and influencers, it matters now, it's the world we live in, to kind of reflect those values more, suddenly a lot of people that were open to Trump might remember some good parts of themselves. Because I think people are complicated. And you're right, in every person there's a bully, but in every person there's always an empathetic part of them as well. Donald Trump does a crackdown on immigration, terrible, terrible crackdown. And what happens for the support for immigration, just itself as a good, rises.
No, anti-immigration.
Anti-immigration sentiment plummets.
Yeah.
Support of immigration itself, irrespective of the policy, rises to 80%, highest it's been in decades. There's something that you can turn on in people. That's what leadership is. And we need that. I think it's possible.
No, I agree with that. I mean, of course. And like historically, it happens.
Yeah.
You can push back and you can, change people's minds if the sadness, the weight of it. But like, what happens to I've become sort of obsessed with this idea of these, these angry white dudes that you were talking about that were untethered, and many of them the whole sort of angle of Democrats used to be like, they're voting against their self interest. That used to be the big thing.
Yeah.
How does that happen? Because it feels good to be angry, And
well, you can't tell people what their interests are is one thing.
I guess, but I'm just economic. Yep. Right. So, but now, like now it's like, I don't want to get more grim. I'll stick with, yes, maybe people. Well, you get all these angry dudes. I mean, and then you offer them, I mean, South Park covered it. The second one,
mm-hmm.
offer them a job in ICE.
Yeah.
As you know, non-officer guys with guns for big money. And that, again, then you get into that philosophy thing where they kill part of themselves to serve this because of their self-interest. And I guess that ties in to me with what you're saying about influencers and about that. If you can get, you know, them out from under their self-interest, which sometimes is just posturing
mm-hmm.
for a particular cause that determines their brand sort of appeal, that but is rooted in almost nothing. I mean, how do you make
momentum becomes momentum almost?
Well, it just becomes like back, you're using it as a marker to sort of determine your brand. Everyone is stuck in honoring the context of the social media platform, right? So arguably, if you really want to do it, there's no free speech. Because you're trying to get onto this platform and get traction with what you have to say in the bits and pieces that you can do it and make it appealing to enough people to get you some sort of recognition so you can get your grift going mm-hmm. or move money into the right direction.
And subscribe to our YouTube.
But
it was one of those fake laughs.
But also there's a difference between this hyper reality and just sort of like, you know, going swimming. So I just think that it's complicated without a unified message.
I think that's true. Let's turn to life. I think we've done enough politics.
Am I the bleakest guy you've had on?
No, and it's going to edit beautifully. It's going to edit.
Darker, but not bleaker?
We've had darker people, right?
No. Pod Save America is brought to you by Mint Mobile. You know what doesn't belong in your epic summer plans? Getting burned by your old wireless bill.
Mm-hmm.
While you're planning beach trips, barbecues, and three-day weekends, your wireless bill should be the last thing holding you back. That's why so many people are making the switch to Mint Mobile.
So many.
With Mint, you can get the coverage and speed you're used to, but for way less money. And for a limited time, Mint Mobile's offering 3 months of unlimited premium wireless service for $15 a month. So while your friends are sweating over data overages and surprise charges, you'll be chilling, literally and financially. But not literally. Say bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless and get 3 months of unlimited service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. Crooked Media's own Nina switched to Mint Mobile last year. She says she can get crystal clear service and the data speeds are excellent. Best of all, she's paying a fraction of what she was paying on her old plan with one of the big wireless companies. Poof, is Nina happy? She is just, she can't stop talking about it. This year, skip breaking a sweat and breaking the bank. Get this new customer offer and your 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month at mintmobile.com/crooked. That's mintmobile.com/crooked. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 a month. Limited time new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
All right, let's talk about life.
Sure.
You ever buy that $14,000 amp?
Yes, long time ago.
You got it. You got the nice amp.
Yeah, wow. I don't spend much money on things, but I did buy that.
Yeah, it's a tube amp.
It's a Macintosh. Some people don't love them, But I've got a good stereo setup with some nice Wilson speakers and the Macintosh amp and the Macintosh preamp and a Riga 6 turntable and a Hama cartridge. And, you know, I kind of, it's waning a little bit. That's the problem with getting obsessed and not being a fully committed nerd to mm-hmm. a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, fully committed nerds have one thing and they do their life with that. Mine kind of
comes,
it dabbles. Yeah. But when I dabble hard, then when it starts to pass, you're like, I'm going to have to build another structure for these records.
Oh, yeah. I get monomaniacal and then move on.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're left with a bunch of objects. Or,
yeah,
or,
sometimes you know, they're great and you can go back to them. Like Boots always seem to come back around.
You got Boots going? Nice.
Well, I got, these ones, I'm trying to figure out if I like them or not. But what I was going to tell you before, sorry, is that in, like I said before, about playing to our audience and having enough, you know, skill to kind of take little shots and but have that fun moment of like, we are kind of like that. That entering the political part of this last special, days before, I changed the tone of how I was going to do it. Because like I said, with that, you know, alpha doggy or whatever thing, that like with the swagger, which is either genuine or just a means for me to confidently, a trick to deliver it. I decided in this one, just go under it. Almost be passive about it. Like, hey, everything's great, you know, everything. And then move from that tone, because I believed in the spirit of what you're doing here, that if I do it like that, you know, people who aren't necessarily like-minded will listen.
Yeah.
And I did some of these shows. I had a guy come up to me in like Skokie or somewhere. And I did all that stuff. And he came up to me and said, you know, I think I'm probably the only Trump supporter in here. And I said, did I get it right? And he said, yeah, man, he's crazy. Like, what do you even do with that?
Well, I think it gets at something important, which is, I feel like a lot of liberals, and gets to the kind of buzzkill thing, a lot of liberals have kind of had convinced themselves that if only we can reach people with the truth, they just don't have the facts. And once they have the facts, we got to get them the facts. We got to make sure the New York Times headlines are accurate, that they capture things correctly. Because if people had the facts, they really knew who Trump was, then they wouldn't do it. But no, a lot of people got behind Trump knowing who he was. And that's a harder, deeper, sadder problem. And that, I think that is where we're at now. I think the first term was, oh, we just have to reach people to make them understand. Now it's wait. They did understand. They did this anyway. This is a bigger problem than we realized.
You have to, like you said, have a leader that believes in liberal democracy.
Yeah.
And can speak to why it's good. You know, even with, you know, creating policy that may, you know, undermine businesses, maybe, you know, creating policy for the benefit of all. You have to somehow re-engage people with the idea that, you know, they have a civic responsibility for those who don't have.
And it has to deliver. It has to deliver for people. Because I do think
that's right.
That people have come to believe that it just doesn't matter, that Democrats can't, they underpromise, they overpromise and they underdeliver if they deliver at all. And really, the federal government just doesn't affect me. And
that's a wealth problem.
It's a wealth problem. I think it's also this is a kind of cultural problem right now, which is the assumption that how things were is how they will be, that there are certain things you can count on, right? Like you can just, the Trump is crazy, but Social Security is going to function. And Trump is crazy, but like he's not going to ruin the whole global economy announcing tariffs for penguins. Like learn from the first term that things don't really get that bad.
Yeah, but that was before they had 2025 in place.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Of course.
You know, and they, you know, all they had was Bannon and, you know, his mystical beliefs, you know, churning out executive orders. But now you have guys that really know all the fucking weak spots of the government who are churning out executive orders.
And they had 4 years to prepare.
Totally.
And second term presidents always know the job better than first term presidents. They rarely get 4 years to be outside so that the policy people, the wonks, can get their plan together.
But also,
that's what's so different.
Sure. But also, how do you get the young people that identify with liberal democratic or leftist politics, you know, to focus on getting involved in being involved in the government?
And I think this is where it's like, what brings all these disparate groups together? What makes people see themselves as part of one movement? Leadership. And we didn't have it. and Democrats didn't have enough trust with non-Democrats to believe the threats, to believe what we were saying about what Trump posed, and Democrats didn't have enough purchase with less engaged lefties to earn their vote and to believe that they could be trusted either to kind of get people excited. And Kamala did a lot to try to fix the damage that Biden had had left, but there wasn't enough time. So Theo Von, Dax Shepard, you, is there something about being a recovered addict that makes you good at hosting a podcast and having a conversation?
Well, I cited as a foundational thing the sort of idea of the seed of AA thought is that one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic about their life and gets out of themselves. So on that premise, maybe. And I just feel also that if you have some experience in recovery, you're very used to people being very candid about showing their emotions and vulnerabilities and telling their stories in of the most horrible things. It's just part of the community and part of how it works. So on that level, maybe.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are miserable and hate their lives, and they're not brave enough to fix it, and they're also not brave enough to do drugs. You know, it takes a little bit of courage, I think, to ruin your life with drugs. You've joked about that, too, in the past. And, like, you know, bravery is just a kind of recklessness that we like. You know, it's recklessness with a good direction.
I don't know if they see it as bravery. I think they're out of control, and if they survive, they can frame it. You know, but, I don't. My joke was, I don't trust anybody who hasn't lost complete control of their life for a few years.
There's a kind of, a willingness to say fuck it, right? There's a fuck it quality, and I think that like
sometimes it's a compulsion more than a willingness.
Well, maybe at some point it started as I'm furious, I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm whatever.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna throw this back and change my circumstances. But there's a vulnerability to it too. I like feel like in the addicts, the people that I know that have had addiction.
Once they've gotten out of it, yeah.
Well, once they've
gotten out. Because the hole is open.
The hole is open, but also I do think that there's a kind of a vulnerability from before too, a kind of a softness that made a pain, right? I think that comes from a vulnerability and that continues after you've beaten it. But I think it's part of, I think, what makes you a good host, right? You are open, right?
Yeah, and I'm pretty like, you know, my empathy is sort of expanded from doing it. And also I'm kind of innately kind of codependent in that, you know, I assume that anyone I'm talking to has their shit together more than me. And I kind of meld with them and I kind of pick up their vibe. And there's certain times where I'll ask Brendan McDonald, my producer, I'm like, did I start talking like an old Jew when I was talking to Mel Brooks? He's like, yeah. And did I start talking a little bit like a black guy when I was talking to a black guy? Happens.
Yeah, but you mirror. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's me. Yeah. I don't know how they do it.
I don't know how they do it either. Yeah. There's something about that you kind of like match somebody's energy. Are we doing that? I think so.
A little.
Yeah.
You're a little guarded.
You think?
A little bit. It's okay.
I think I am. Well, I can bring it down.
No, you don't have to. It's your show. You got to drive.
I don't even know how to be. I don't even know what's the guard? What should I take down? What do you think it is?
I think you have purpose. I think that we're all scared, but you have to sort of keep it together for the operation.
I think that's true locally and globally. I think I want to make sure, I know you as a performer.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure we don't land in the fucking grave.
Yeah.
You know, I want to, I want to be out of it by the end. So I think that's right.
Well, I think that if you watch the special that I do, you know, I do walk a tightrope, but it definitely, it comes out funny. And it took a lot of time to do that.
I remember you in the Conan days. Like, I remember watching you on Conan.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have known you were on drugs and drinking that. Like, when you were in that.
Well, I wasn't sloppy, you know. And a lot of times, I didn't do it the day of those shows. You know, I don't think, you know, a lot of people think I was on coke for that HBO half hour at the Fillmore in 95. I was just sweaty. I don't think I was on coke. I do know on my first Comedy Central half hour, I had done coke the night before and I didn't sleep well. Hmm. But I wasn't getting jacked to work.
You weren't.
No.
Even now, like I forget when I'm thinking about, like, I don't sort you into the category of, oh, guys that did a lot of drinking and coke, because you strike me as a nerd. You're like a nerdy guy, kind of contained, Jewish. Like, I think of you like that. And even when I think of you from the Conan days, I think of you as being like a, not a party guy. I think of you being like a record guy.
Yeah, I think I was like, I kind of rode a line. You know, I grew up in, you know, towny culture in Albuquerque, but I was from Jersey and I was very compelled towards, you know, higher pursuits. I wanted to really be an intellectual. But I do have at some point, you know, a rock and roll element. I was never really a nerd. I was more of an awkward person, unfocused. I think nerds are awkward, focused people, and they can find community in that. I was just an uncomfortable guy that knew how to be funny and sort of move through all different cliques. But it was never that focused. And I kind of took to, and still do to, a kind of rock and roll sensibility. So it's that combination of that with pretty, I think, I don't like using the word, but neurotic, anxious Jewishness. So it's kind of a hybrid. I think that Randy Newman once told Lorne Michaels many years ago, and Lorne told Jim Biederman, who was producing me on a show for Broadway Video. It was a streaming show that it was before streaming, though. But Randy said I was a verbessin, which is a sourpuss.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I was a cranky guy, but I didn't know quite how to make it funny. I don't think I have the you know, real cranky guys who are naturally funny. It's a rare thing. You know, like Lewis Black is good at that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Burr at some time, just this sort of put upon, you know, kind of anger that doesn't cross over into intense anger,
yeah,
which isn't fundamentally entertaining, which is where I would go. I think over time I've become a little more cranky funny.
That's interesting. Why is that? And I think part of it is, for whatever reason, like you're there's a way in which with like Bill Burr, Lewis Black, that you're rooting for them even when they're
populist crank.
Yeah, they're populist, and
I'm a heady guy.
Yeah, yeah, you got.
I'm more of a poet in terms of how my brain processes things.
It never rhymed though. That's a shame.
No, but it's all free verse. Occasionally, there's a rhyme, but I take them right out.
You do, yeah. You gotta take them out.
Yeah, rhymes are cheap.
Cheap can't.
Rhymes and puns, no, can't do it.
Yeah, we do it.
That's okay.
We do it.
Sure, it's cute.
There's a way in which now, I don't know. You seem more like comfortable as a performer, as a stand-up, which is amazing. How you've been doing it for such a long time? Was it like, I know that like when I was in politics, I remember when I got a job as a speechwriter, like, I have several chips on my shoulder. A couple of them are still there, but I've seen them fall off. Like when I've had milestones, like and you know, you say you can't get you know that outside validation can't really change how you feel. I don't think that's true. I think it absolutely can.
Totally.
Do you think for you, success was it financial success, acclaim? Did those things matter in how you are on stage? Did it make you feel comfortable, safer, freer? What?
I think that. And I've said it before that for a long time, however long it takes, you know, your comic's job is to pretend like they're not afraid, you know, and then eventually the fear will leave you. And that's sort of a big day. And I think in terms of success, just the fact that I was able to build an audience of grown-up people mostly, you know, mostly thinky, creative, you know, disgruntled, you know, people, you know, I kind of talk about in the special. You know, I worry about alienating them, but there's also some part of me that wants to a little. But I think that once I got an audience and I had a freedom of mind that I knew would be received, that it did help my comedy. And I guess that's success. But ultimately, I have been working a long time at this. And I think along with that fearlessness, you know, especially in this special, was one of the only, it's the only special where beforehand I didn't let my brain undermine me for dumb shit. There's some part of my brain that prepares that way. I've got to find something to make me uncomfortable. And it just didn't happen. And I was more grounded in this special than I ever have been because I had purpose. Like I always kind of do, but I had a different purpose, both to my audience, to the way I thought about culture and politics, and also to the risks I wanted to take around personal things. Like a long time ago, I really set out to not talk about anything that wasn't from my point of view, because I could own that and no one could take it. And anytime that I'd see similar things, I'd have to sort of like go, well, is it that similar? I'll just lose it. You know, I want it to be mine. So the risks I took in the last two bits around trauma and around grief were, it took a long time to work those out. So I just feel like that I have a confidence in how I do what I do that is much more grounded than it's ever been. But yeah, validation is still too important to me.
Is it?
Yeah.
Who do you want it from?
I don't know. My parents. It's always about the parents.
So, yeah.
I mean, because like if you don't have a voice in yourself that you've evolved because of being, you know, emotionally, you know, manipulated one way or the other in a negative way by, you know, your early experiences, it's hard to have a voice in your head that says good job.
And you don't have that even now?
No, I do, you know, but I still, like, I know it, but then when other people don't know it as much as I do, it makes me upset.
Yeah.
With this one, the stuff that, like, I felt like it was really the best work that I've done in terms of, from like, the risks were different. The last special was about grief and, you know, at least 20, 25 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And this one was back to a sort of almost a three-act structure, you know, where, you know, I do the political, cultural stuff, then I tell them I want to just be entertaining and I do that. And then I get into personal stuff. But I do feel like the stuff that I thought needed to get out there in terms of not the stuff, like you said before, there's a lot of stuff in this special that goes, you know, undiscussed. That's gnarly shit and deep shit. But, you know, the stuff that landed, I'm okay with because I felt like it was not being said, yeah. You know, in a way that was like no one can deny my skill set. So as a comic, if I'm going to take on what's going on in comedy in relation to culture and I do it in a funny way, then I've achieved something because a lot of comics are scared to talk about it. They're afraid of audiences. And, you know, you just got to really get that ratio into your head. It was, you know, 75 million to 77.5 million. Not every room is full of monsters, and certainly not in LA. And that there has to be some, you have to have the guts to be a stand-up and say what you want to say. Again, you know, it's dicey when you sort of take on people in your world, but when it reflects on the world at large in a negative way, I think it's ripe. But to the point, like, I felt good about it. I articulated it well, and going into it, I was 100% confident in the set. And I feel good about it. And I'm fortunate in that it was received very well, which is not always the case.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start investing like an expert, even if you're an expert at something else. Acorns is the financial wellness app that helps you invest for your future, save for tomorrow, and spend smarter today. Acorns makes it easy to start doing more with your money. In fact, you can start automatically investing with just your spare change. You don't need to be a finance whiz. Acorns puts your money into an expert-built portfolio to make sure you're investing wisely, not wildly. Plus, Acorns can support your money goals in life, a new car, first home, investing for your kids, saving up for retirement, and so much more. Acorns even has a checking account that automatically invests for you and an emergency fund that grows your money, and it's all in one easy-to-use app. The app is great. It's super important to invest. You don't have to have like a ton of money to invest. In fact, Acorns, you know, encourage you to just sort of, you know, put a little bit away here and there, and then basically it does the investing for you, and you can watch your money grow over time. It's a really cool app, and it's really helpful. Sign up now, and Acorns will boost your new account with a $5 bonus investment. Join the over 14 million all-time customers who've already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/crooked or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 2 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/crooked.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at Crooked Con for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at crookedcon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
I guess technically you're cusp, but I think of you as like a quintessential Gen X.
Yeah, I think so.
Comic.
Last year boomers. So it's
yeah, you're right there. Yeah. You're right. But Gen X energy all the way through.
Sure.
Right there with the kind of in the sort of
there's probably a little too much Led Zeppelin in me to be fully Gen X, but yeah.
You can grunge it up a little, I suppose.
Sure I did. Yeah, but it was later though.
Later, yeah. You went through your grunge.
The groundwork had been laid by acts from the '70s. So.
But why did we have had a bunch of baby boomer presidents?
I'm not running.
No, first of all, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one less thing to fucking worry about. Imagine that. Ugh, that'd be annoying. But just you heckling Democrats back at you. Just what a disaster.
I don't know. Gavin's doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's more suited to it, honestly, than you.
Oh,
yeah,
he wants it pretty bad. I can't, like, I know what it's like to think you are speaking your truth and to be completely saturated in talking points that you don't know anymore. Mm. I mean, I did Air America for a year every morning. And you realize, like, I didn't think this.
I don't remember your show being that talking pointsy.
No, it's not, but it's the tone.
Yeah, yeah.
That you're honoring a narrative.
But we seem to have skipped over Gen X in terms of presidents, and there's a sort of a gap in terms of even our representation. We went right from a lot of boomer members of Congress. There's obviously Gen Xers in there, but we went right from the boomers to the millennials as well. Why is it that Gen X hasn't really shown up? They've also moved to the right more than millennials have. Mm. What was something about your generation that kind of had this sort of?
Well, I think it was probably the beginning of that sort of self-centered entitlement and need to define yourself in a unique way that was based on, you know, music, fashion, you know, bits and pieces of, you know, esoteric wisdom from old books and whatnot. I think it was probably, you know, the boomers are selfish in a different way, you know, because they built the world and now as they were looking down the tunnel of death, they kind of want to end it.
They want to be buried in their pyramids.
Well, they just, I think there's a part of narcissism that it's like, if the world ends at the same time they do, they don't miss anything. And I think Gen X is probably guilty of a kind of the beginning of a terminal uniqueness on an individual level and not so hip to, you know, real civic community.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm really spitballing. I don't really think in terms of generations that much. I do know that the boomers need to get out of the way.
There's the Gen X comics. John Stewart's in there. You're in there. Bill Maher is in that group, I think.
He's a little older.
Is he a little older? But
I think he's kind of solid boomer.
You think? Is he older?
Yeah, he's got to be close to 70. Somebody.
Let's get a Bill Maher age check.
Work.
Nice.
69, yeah.
Nice. Famously 69. Oh, right. We talked to him about it. I had him on.
That's pretty solid boomer shit. But Janine, you know, John, sure. You know, some of the other Gen Xers, you know, Patton. And then there's a bunch of other, you know, younger guys. The alt comedy scene, for whatever it did, was mostly Gen Xers and some millennials, I guess.
Yeah.
It was an insulated community that was based a lot in kind of snark. And, you know, snark doesn't age well because it doesn't run that deep.
Yeah. And there's something about it, too, that's snark, you have to be on the outside and you have to not want to be on the inside.
Well, that's
right?
Your answer right there.
Yeah. I think that's it. There's something about Gen X that was like, you know what? We're just going to, we'll be back here.
Yeah.
We'll be back here with our zines.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I think that's it.
I think it was a mistake. I think you should have gotten in the ring with us.
I'm the last boomer. Don't blame me.
You're right. Okay. You're right. I take that back. So you're a catastrophizer. I was thinking about this because I went back and I watched parts of the special from Bleak to Dark. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm a catastrophizer as well. So if I'm on the phone call with my fiance, I'm engaged. Second time. This one's going to take. But
how long have you been engaged?
Like 6 months.
Okay.
6 months. You're planning still the wedding.
Good. Oh, good.
Yeah, we're planning the wedding.
It's not like a 6 year
engagement.
Yeah.
The last one, we didn't plan the wedding. And I think that that was a sign.
This is second marriage?
Second engagement.
Second. Okay.
There was no first marriage.
Okay. Okay.
I made a lot of changes when I turned 40.
Uh-huh.
A lot of changes.
Yeah? Like what?
I was no longer engaged once I was 40.
Yeah.
I actually never was single in my 30s.
Yeah.
I was single when I was 29. I met somebody. And then the next time I was single, I was 40. So I forgot to be single in my 30s. And
yet you did it again.
Well, if I thought it was going to be like when I was in my 20s. It is not.
No.
When you're in your 40s.
A little more work.
Yes. Yes. You can't get my dunk gone.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a dunk.
Yeah. The game starts to fade.
And now I'm 40?
Yeah. But you look good. Yeah.
I'm okay. I'm working on doing good. Pilates. Do you Pilates?
No, I do. I do like kind of a full body
massage,
flexibility workout. And then I run a few days a week.
You run?
This morning I did. Yeah.
Where do you run?
I do a hike out in Glendale sometimes. And then other times I just do intervals on the treadmill at Equinox.
Hmm. Okay.
I like Equinox.
Okay.
I'm an elitist.
You seem to be aging well. I think comedians age well.
Oh, that is not true.
Not physically. They become ghouls. But I'm saying that that mentally, some of the great, like...
You're going to have to give me an example.
Well, I think comedians that have tried to stay kind of sharp and curious about the world, I think you're one of them. There's got to be a couple more.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a faulty premise, but you said it confidently.
I think Seinfeld is somebody that's keep trying to do new material, and I don't do like you can like or dislike what Seinfeld does.
Oh yeah,
But even the other day, like he gave some answer about woke stuff, and it got some blowback, and he actually came back and he said, you know what, I was wrong about that, and he actually gave a really good answer. He thought about it. He came back and he said, you know what. What I said was stupid, and actually, if the goalposts move, I should hit the goalpost. That's my job.
Sure.
And I thought that was cool.
I think that what happened with Jerry ultimately is that he was really a guy that didn't speak much publicly, and then you know, just because of the advent of podcasting and the needs of the new publicity environment, all of a sudden Jerry was never shutting up. So everybody saw Jerry for Jerry, and you do with that what you will.
Okay, I'll do with it what I will.
I'm glad he apologized, and you feel good about that.
Who else? Let's do some more beefs. What do you think about Bill Maher?
I can't do it. You know, I can't. You know, I don't. Tone. I always had a problem with his tone. I think I did. I did Politically Correct years ago.
Yeah, I'm sure you did
a couple of times, maybe. Yeah. And I think I did Real Time maybe once or twice. Mm-hmm. But
that's when you were dating Ann Coulter at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a dark time. I tried to help her. She's lost cause. I couldn't do it.
There's
nothing I could do with all my years of experience in and out of bed that could help her.
Okay.
So, no, I don't know. Like, I feel with Bill that there is this, and it happens with some of the other boomers, there's this desperate chasing of relevance that, you know, changes someone's mind in terms of how they approach what they do, and also kind of makes the whole undertaking feel desperate. And, you know, outside of, you know, his ideas about primarily, I think, wokeness, I don't know. It's just not for me. I know his joke writer. You know, he's got good joke writers who know how to write for his tone. And I've known a couple of those guys. They were comics, and they're good guys. But I can't see past, you know, the desperation and what he's willing to do to stay in the conversation.
And what do you think about the death of, like, you know, Late Show's gone. Conan Show's obviously gone.
Yeah,
it's coming undone. This place that I know, I'm sure for you, was this pinnacle of where comics went, what comedy was, like
was
from Carson to Letterman to Conan.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I think it's just the nature of what we talked about before, is that if the bar has been lowered to consuming only clips, you know, which is dictated by media platforms, that this whole idea of, like, you know, algorithms and what people's attention span can and can't do, it's sort of a, I don't know if it's a catch-22, but it's like, even with any streamer you work on, it's like, well, our algorithm says people can't pay attention for this one. And I'm like, but not my people. And if you keep promoting that, they won't. I mean, if something is good, they'll stay in it. I guess the format and the nature of show business has just, again, shifted to entrepreneurs and media bubbles that are self-driven by, you know, individuals or tribal entities, and that the whole framing of show business being this, you know, it's the talk show, here come the celebrities. It's just, people don't care anymore, and they're all chasing clicks on, you know, for quips of, you know, having interesting people do dumb shit.
And we're going to bring those pies in a second. But the,
oh, God damn it. I knew there was a big closer.
I want to end with this. It's a serious question, and it's where I was going to before. But look, when I'm on the phone with Ari and the phone cuts out, I think they're dead. I just assume the building has collapsed. Truly, sure. Earthquake, a 9/11. Truly, if they're in New York, I think a 9/11 has happened. Like, sure. I really go there.
Yeah.
You're a catastrophizer. Uh-huh. You've done it your whole life. And, you know, you've been through a terrible loss. Your plane hit the mountain.
Yeah.
Did it change how you view catastrophe? Does it change how you allow your mind to create catastrophe all the time?
No. What it changed was my sense of mortality. It did not change. Like, it doesn't, you know, tragic loss of somebody you love, that's not my go-to catastrophe. I didn't see that coming at all. I mean, my parents are both still alive, you know. It's not great, but I didn't see what happened to Lynn. There was no way I could have ever seen that coming. So, you know, when somebody dies tragically, you know, all the other catastrophizing about me and cancer, or, you know, what someone's going to say about me, or the world, or the fires, or anything else, when somebody dies, it does make me more scared in relationship, because it's happened, but it also sort of makes you realize just how fragile it all is, and how there is no real kind of universal order to it. And, you know, there's no way to answer the question why, and that's just life. So I don't, it didn't diminish my catastrophizing, but it did make me realize how fragile life is.
And I
too
think
heavy
we're not,
for an answer.
No, I just think now we're ready to start. Let's record.
Oh, good.
Let's
finally
get the things
Jesus,
going.
We got warmed up.
And now we're in it.
Yeah, good.
Mark Maron, good to have you.
Thank you. Nice
Thank
to
you.
Be here.
That's all for this week. Thank you to Mark Maron for Stomp Bake By. We'll be back in your podcast feeds on Tuesday with our usual episode with me, John, and Tommy.
If you want to listen to Pod Save America ad-free or get access to our subscriber Discord and exclusive podcasts, consider joining our Friends of the Pod community at crooked.com/friends or subscribe on Apple Podcasts directly from the Pod Save America feed. Also, please consider leaving us a review to help boost this episode and everything we do here at Crooked. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are David Toledo, Emma Illick-Frank, and Saul Rubin. Our associate producer is Farah Safari. Austin Fisher is our senior producer. Reed Cherlin is our executive editor. Adrian Hill is our head of news and politics. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Naomi Sengel is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Haley Jones, Ben Hefcoat, Mia Kelman, Kirill Pelaviv, David Tolles, and Ryan Young. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
You've made an AI investment for your team. You rolled it out, and a handful of people use it every day. Everyone else? They tried it, but nothing clicked. They went back to what they knew. That's not a people problem. It's a product problem. Superhuman fixes that. From the makers of Grammarly, Superhuman brings AI into every tool your team already works in, so they get instant help with drafting, summarizing, and finding information. With most AI tools, you need to know what to ask, how to ask it, and how to connect it to your work. Most people don't have the time or patience to get there. So the gap between the best people on your team and everyone else gets bigger. With Superhuman, your team doesn't need to build new habits or spend hours on training. Superhuman is already there, with the right context and ready before they even have to ask. When every person on your team works at their best, that's when your AI investments start to compound. See what Superhuman can do at superhuman.com. That's superhuman.com.